This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of November 23rd, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 423. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And on the big deal feature, Mubin Sheikh knows more than most Canadians about political and religious violence. The former teenage jihadist became a Canadian Security Intelligence Service operative who exposed a terrorist plot. I sat down with Mubin Sheikh at the Vancouver International Security Summit to talk about his de-radicalization work with Parents for Peace and more. This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Toronto-born and raised Mubin Sheikh was a Royal Canadian Army cadet who became a radical jihadist in his teens. He had second thoughts after Al-Qaeda's September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. Over the next 2 years, Sheikh studied Islamic theology in Syria and de-radicalized. He returned to Canada, became an undercover agent for the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, and helped expose the Toronto 18 terrorist plot. Sheikh has taught at Seneca College and the University of Ottawa. He also works with Parents for Peace, an American charity that runs a national de-radicalization helpline and intervention network across all ideologies. I sat down with Mubin Sheikh at the 2025 Vancouver International Security Summit on October 17th. At the time, it was just a week into the ceasefire in the Israel-Hamas war. For the last 2 years, Hamas sympathizers have protested on Canadian streets. Radical elements have even targeted the Jewish community with vandalism and violence. I started by asking Mubin Sheikh if the ceasefire would turn down the temperature in Canada.
Yeah, it's a very good question. It remains to be seen how people will respond. I am not that optimistic that it will certainly not end the grievances that people have, because ultimately, you know, some people say that it has nothing to do with establishing a state of Palestine or Palestinians. It's really to undermine Israel and delegitimize Israel as a nation state. So if you think about the tactics that were attempted previously, BDS in particular, that remains a core component of a lot of these protests, right? I don't want to call them pro-Palestinian protests. They're more anti-Israel protests than anything else. So if that is the understanding, that is to delegitimize the state of Israel, then the ceasefire is irrelevant. It's a moot point. It doesn't do anything in that regard. So I am inclined to believe that you will continue to see these protests. I think they may lighten up a little bit in terms of the numbers, because people will see that, okay, while the war is over, the images of destruction and suffering and death will stop. And that provides the basis of a lot of this emotional grievance-based mobilization. So it would follow that if that is taken out of the equation, then you would think that it would have a resulting effect on the other side. But I do think there will be some effect to that point, but the core issue is the delegitimization of Israel, and so that will just continue to occur.
Yeah, we've seen activists in the environmental movement basically drop everything they had on the climate change file and move straight over to this. And in some ways, it's becoming more clear what their goals were from the beginning, which is really anti-capitalism.
Yes.
There's a school of thought that because Israel is such an ally of the United States, if you take Israel out of the equation, weaken Israel, end Israel, like some of them actually want, then you're going to get closer to the end of the United States' dominance for the past almost century and change the world economic system and political system.
Right. And think about who else believes that exact same thing, that there is this Western hegemony that needs to be brought down, needs to be undermined, the societies need to be divided from within with hateful narratives pitting communities against other communities. This is exactly what our foreign adversaries want. And you think it's by accident that the hammer and sickle flags keep showing up at a lot of these protests? I mean, it's telling you, it's you know, signaling to you exactly who's behind it. Russia is definitely very active in this space. Iran is very active in this space, and so is China. Remember, China is allied with Russia. They're giving them all kinds of support, of course, in the war against in war in Ukraine. Iran, for sure, with their drone warfare and supporting Russia that way. So it's definitely something that foreign adversaries have capitalized on, have been exploiting. They're flooding the zone with all sorts of misinformation, disinformation that is deliberately designed to elicit emotional reactions so that it mobilizes people to action. And so I agree with that assessment that Israel is seen as a proxy, a satellite of the West in the region. Take it out, that takes out one of the blocks of Western hegemony.
Yeah, we do have, in Western Canada as a whole, maybe not as much here as in Edmonton, for instance, a very large Ukrainian community. We do have a large Chinese diaspora, large Iranian diaspora, people that have left those countries to start a new life in Canada, contribute to Canada, and have seen this end up on the streets. Do you think that that's part of the message too? Is this also a case of foreign repression?
Yeah, or a way of intimidation, right? It is also telling those communities that we can bring the fight to your doorstep. You haven't escaped anything. A lot of these people still have family that are overseas that can be used as a way to intimidate the population. I mean, not everyone has come here with good intentions. All right, you have, we know who have been tracking this, like you have Iranian agents who have also come over here, Chinese agents who have also come over here. So it's unfortunately still a very active, it's narrative warfare, really, if you think about it. So for these diaspora communities in particular, it's they have to be very careful because on one hand, if they are seen very publicly doing this and then knowing that these foreign adversaries are collecting on what's happening here, they're checking to see who's at the protests, they're monitoring social media, they're hoovering up all that information, who's doing what, where, and you know, it's very easy to exploit these networks. When you try to find the right influencer, maybe it's give them a position, give them some money, give them some sense of ego fulfillment. It's a theater of operation. The streets of Canada have become a theater of operation for foreign adversaries.
And one of those leading groups is based here in Vancouver, Samidun,
yeah.
Which this time last year was designated by the United States and Canada as a terrorist entity. Since then, it has still been allowed to remain registered.
So this is exactly how foreign interference works. We're seeing it play out before our very eyes. This is a perfect example of that. And she's not the only one. I mean, there are many others that have been, that are non-Iranians who have been co-opted in this cause. A lot of this, you see this Marxist-Hamas alliance that we were talking about earlier about who else wants to see the end of capitalism and the end of Western hegemony. And so they are using these useful idiots, which is what they are, to promote their message because it looks different when it comes from a white Caucasian Canadian person than if it comes from an accent-laden foreigner, quote-unquote, that perception alone, right? So what is the point of designating groups as terrorist entities if we're not going to actually charge people? And it should be an automatic process where if you're designated as a terrorist organization, how could you possibly keep any kind of charitable status? It's incredulous to me that we would even be needing to have this conversation. And look at how long it's going to take and for what purpose? Even if you take away the charitable status from that, what is that even going to do? It's not going to stop their protesting. It's not going to stop the narrative warfare that they're engaged in. And it's not going to prevent her from going back to Iran, possibly even collecting funding from other sources. Right? You can call them private donations. You can set up a GoFundMe and you can have people donate money that way, right? I mean, or if there are other ways, of course, if they want to get more sophisticated, like Bitcoin payments or even Hawala transfers, I mean, those are all in play. So it's just incredulous to me that we, do we really take the threat seriously? I mean, is it a lot of just theater, right? Is it security theater? Oh, we designated these groups. Okay, but we haven't charged anybody for being members of these groups. So why did we designate them? For what purpose? We're not ending their activities. So that's what we have to ask ourselves is, are we actually putting up obstacles rather than actually producing solutions?
How have things changed at Parents for Peace? Have you received more calls from parents or from friends or relatives of people who have become radicalized and joined a movement and put aside rational thought? Have you seen an uptick?
Yeah, that's a good question, because we are seeing more calls. It has increased. It's really after October 7 attacks, is in the recent 2-year period, we've seen an uptick of calls. But we were seeing an uptick of calls previous to that, especially around COVID times. QAnon really took off at that time. A lot of anti-COVID conspiracy theories really proliferated around that time. And so we are seeing more calls. And like, you know, the example you gave of like, it's, I laugh when I hear this, you know, 16-year-old white kid from rural America talking about my people, the Muslims. And it's like, your people? I mean, like, what part of you, how are they your people? How did they become your people? And if, you know, you can go down the psychological rabbit hole and kind of look at, like vicarious suffering. So you're watching the suffering on these clips, you're seeing the images. We cannot escape those images in the globalized world that we live in. And people see that, they see the suffering, and then they have this vicarious identification. It's like, look at what's happened to these people. This is horrible. These are my people. Or at least, this should not be happening to those people. I side with these people because they're oppressed. That's the very simplistic narrative that a lot of people have come to subscribe to. So when you have mostly white people who are protesting against Israel's war in Gaza on Hamas, they see these images and they're like, we want this to stop. And so I start to identify with this suffering population. And especially now with how kids are so constantly online, when they're inundated and flooded with these images, think about even psychologically what it's doing to the brain. Like we look at this stuff, we know it's harmful. We will get vicarious trauma from watching other people suffering trauma. So now you're dealing with this perfect storm of young kids who their brains are physically not developed. They don't have good emotional regulation. Their critical thinking skills are not that developed. Now they're consuming all this material, getting this vicarious trauma. Are you surprised now that they are responding in maladaptive ways? So as you know, imagery of these sorts of things keep occurring and keep proliferating and people keep consuming that, the end result is going to be the same, these maladaptive response mechanisms.
The people that are brought to your attention who become radicalized, are they doing that as just because they got nothing else in their lives, because everything else around them is falling apart,
it's crumbling
by society, yeah, and by just economic trends that are affecting especially the middle class, which used to be so strong?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've I guess different perspectives have tried to look at the economic angle. It's hard to know how much of it actually, while it can animate the context, inform the context, I wonder how much of it is actually at least consciously / deliberately used as a reason. So when you ask, for example, we at Parents for Peace see this across the board. We see it in quote unquote poor families, middle class families, even well-to-do families, affluent families. They have both parents are there, very highly educated. The mother's a lawyer, the kid's the neo-Nazi. The father's a police officer, the kid joins ISIS. Like we see these, and I see this as like identity collapse. So you could kind of see, I think it spans the you know, that economic spectrum. But I think there is something to be said about that, because when the children of these families who are facing these crises, middle class, losing their businesses, the family, they just see this, you know, everything is crashing, right? Everything is, you know, and we see it in our own narratives, like, you know, whenever, you know, the election goes one way, the people who are on the other side are like, Canada has fallen. You know, it's over. It's like this very defeatist attitude and mentality. And then remember, that is fomented, that's proliferated by or exacerbated by foreign adversaries. They are watching all this. They know exactly what people are upset about. And when it has a kernel of truth in it, where people say, yeah, there is, like, look at what's happening with Canada. We're like kind of on the back foot a little bit because of politics in the US. And so they do see that, but then people take it to another level, right? They, now it's like, oh, it's completely gone. In the US, the biggest narrative, which is a narrative that's being spread around the world, is civil war, right? Civil war is coming, civil war is coming. And some of these people believe it so much, they want it to happen. And because in their mind, they think that's the only option that's available and that's left. So in this larger ecosystem and environment, young people are seeing this. They're seeing their parents losing their homes, losing their jobs, their businesses that were run for years and years and years. It you know, the economy adapts, right? It's not like it used to be, where mom and pop shops, they went on for decades and decades. We saw they took the first big hit during COVID, right? This was and we saw kids coming out of that environment. They were more depressed. They were feeling like everything was falling apart because they had been removed from their social circles. So that disruption of socialization, of normal, natural youth socialization process, it was disrupted completely. And you could see the results of that. So it is in that larger, the economics is definitely a factor, one among a number of factors. And I say this only to really illustrate how bad the problem is that it's not just coming from one side. You cannot just fix it by addressing that issue. You need to address a multitude of issues, many of which overlap with each other. And I think more importantly, many of those overlapping issues, which kind of hit up against identity formation. Who am I? What is my role in society, in life? This is a question that youth cannot answer, even adults cannot answer, and it's causing this disruption in their mind, and it's showing up in disruptive behavior.
What is the key to removing a young person, or any person of any age, but you focus on the young who become radicalized? How do you get them back on track? What is the key? What is the common element with every case that you've gone through that's been the aha moment that turns them back into who they used to be, that they realize the mistake that they made, and that they realize that they can't continue going on the path they've been going on? What is that moment? Mm-hmm. Is there a common thread among the various ones in the far right and the far left that you notice?
Yeah, so everything, it's a case-by-case basis, right? Every individual is unique. So one thing, what we do is it's identifying, so what's going on with this person, right? One thing we look at first is, are there mental health issues? Are there, for example, formal diagnoses of these individuals? So you might get a kid who presents as an ISIS supporter, but as you discover the details of the case, it's like, wait a second, this kid is on the autism spectrum disorder. He's on the autism spectrum. Now, again, it's a spectrum. What does that mean? You could, the affect could present itself very obviously. So you'll look at the kid and you'll be like, okay, there's something not right with this kid. But you can kind of, it's a spectrum, so you can see on a different part of the spectrum, the affect might not be as prominent, but the attributes are still there. Mechanical thinking, maybe almost like obsessive compulsive disorder sometimes. So you have to look at what's going on with the kid, right? Is there a mental illness? Are they being prescribed medications, things like that? So you basically look to see what's happening with this kid. Obviously, you have to look at what's happening in their life. How did they grow up? But eventually, you come to understand that, okay, these are the main issues that we see. A kid's being bullied at school, right? Guess what? He wants to be, now he puts on the ISIS costume. Well, now I'm a big bad wolf. You're bullying me. You don't want to hang out with me. I'm isolated. Well, I'm going to make sure that I'm isolated, or that you stay away from me. I'm dangerous now, right? You've outgrouped me. I'm going to embrace that outgrouping, and I'm going to show you, right? So you get that as well. They typically use it as a costume. That's the very common element that I see, especially in Islamist cases, where it's like a white kid. It's almost like getting back at their parents, right? You have a girl. I remember there's this one commercial that they played, and it was this back and forth between a mother and a daughter. And it's like, she's like, don't tell me you're wearing that to school. Why not, mom? I'm allowed to wear whatever I want, blah, 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 this and that. And then at the end, the mom's like, take off that hijab right now. And the conversation goes like it went 20 years ago. Was it 20 years ago? With skirts and mini skirts and chain and jewelry and tattoos and whatever. So we see this, there is this kind of conflict between parent and child for a whole host of reasons, identity conflict, grievances, you name it, adventure, being cool, the cool factor, the so-called cool factor. So we identify what we think are their particular issues. We develop rapport with them. We convince them, we show them through genuineness, through compassion, non-judgmental approach. And it's very interesting for me, because I came from the other side of the fence, where I was hunting people like this, pursuing them for prosecution. Now it's not that. It's not, I'm not persecuting or prosecuting. I'm genuinely interested in helping you. And what we do, and the other key ingredient, is using former extremists like myself who have been down that path. Or my colleague, Arno Michaelis, who's a former neo-Nazi. He was a leader of a neo-Nazi band. He had a big group. He was a member, you know, they did a lot of bad stuff to people. And when he tells that kid that, hey, I was in the movement for X number of years. I got the swastika tattoos and I've done all that. And a lot of these kids, like, they've just never had an opportunity to talk to someone like that. Even in some of the cases that I've used, where there was a 17-year-old white kid who, supposedly converted to Islam. I say convert to extremism, but I tell them at the outset, you are not going to out-Muslim me. I pray more than you. I read the Quran more than you. You're not going to out-Muslim me, right? But I don't do it in a, you know, I'm like a, you know, what do you call it, like top-down approach, prescriptive. I'm actually telling them this to show them that, hey, like, there is a path of study. This is how you do it. And I frequently notice, like, these guys come in hardcore, and I'm an Islamist, or I'm super Muslim, and then they can't keep up the 5 daily prayers, because it's not easy when you're at school, when you're at work, and you need to be in a state of ablution, and easier said than done. So, you know, identifying what the main issues are, and that is done through this very compassionate, and there are different techniques, like motivational interviewing is a technique where you elicit from the person their own motivations. Why do you think this benefits you? How do you think this is going to help you in 20 years? Do you think any woman is going to want to marry you if you keep this kind of persona up? No woman is going to think, I have a future with this person, or I want to have kids with this person. So having these kinds of conversations with young kids, parents can't have these conversations. Very few parents can have these sorts of conversations with their parents. So we become their buddy. We become almost like a father figure to them in many cases. And I think the key core ingredient here is that rapport and relationship development. And you do that through all these different techniques. But I think the most important thing is to be genuine, to be sincere. It's like one kid, when we started, when I told him I was an undercover, and he got arrested and he was in prison, and he got an 11-year sentence eventually. But in the beginning, it started off with, you know, he told his lawyer, I'm not going to talk to Mubin until he asks Allah for forgiveness for what he did. And it ended with, "You're like family to me now." And that only happened because I, at the end, you know, I told him, I came on and I said, "Why do you think I'm even here? I don't need to be here. I can move this, I can move on to another case, no problem. I'll never think about you again." I'm like, "But I am here because I wish I had somebody like me talking to me like I'm talking to you." And when they see that, when they see me in them and I see them in me, that's when you put them back on track.
And if there's anyone watching or listening who knows someone who needs help, or even someone that's watching or listening that might be someone that needs to speak to someone like you, how do they get in touch with Parents for Peace?
Yep, Parents for Peace has a website. It's parents, P-A-R-E-N-T-S, the number 4, peace.org. You'll see there's a helpline number there. There's also an information piece. You can just, whatever information you have, it's completely confidential. Legally protected, we have insurance, all that stuff. We don't share information with government agencies. There's like a very strict block. Reach out to us, there'll be an intake process and we'll see what we can do. Like, I'm a parent, I really feel for the parents. They feel sometimes shame and guilt. Am I a bad parent? Is it my fault? Is my kid a bad kid? Right? These are the kinds of questions that come up, and who are they gonna ask those questions to? So we encourage them, that those of you who are watching, you know, reach out to us and we will at least help along this process.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In FocusTaiwan.tw, ex-Ukrainian colonel urges Taiwan's president to engage in wartime rehearsals. Andrei Ordunovich, a retired Ukrainian Air Force colonel, said that Ukraine should have trained for possible enemy maneuvers before Russia launched its invasion in 2022. Quote, "We did not respond with appropriate actions before the full-scale invasion," he said. "You don't need to repeat our mistakes." Ordunovich lauded Taiwan's efforts to develop decentralized command capabilities. In Kyoto News, China reimposes Japanese seafood import suspension. Japan and China have seen a flare-up in tensions in recent days, with Beijing harshly criticizing Prime Minister Takeuchi's November 7th parliamentary remarks that a military attack on Taiwan could present a, quote, survival-threatening situation for Japan, indicating the potential involvement of its self-defense forces. Just earlier this month, China had resumed purchasing marine products from Japan after lifting a blanket import ban imposed in August 2023 following the start of the water discharge from the crippled Fukushima nuclear power plant. In Hong Kong Free Press, Singapore official apologizes after calling Hong Kong football players and fans idiots in video. In a live stream clip circulating online, David Neo congratulates Singapore's victorious football players, saying that, quote, "All the Hong Kong fans were bloody idiots, and the players, they also played like idiots, but you all played like lions," end quote. The Lion City beat Hong Kong 2-1 in the Asian Cup qualifiers at Kai Tak Stadium, dashing Hong Kong's chance to compete in the tournament in Saudi Arabia. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, federal charges filed against a man who returned to Portland Immigration and Customs Enforcement Building 8 times. Christopher Griffin, 37, is charged with failing to obey a lawful order, criminal trespass, and obstructing federal property. Griffin is one of 39 people who have faced either federal misdemeanor or felony charges stemming from protest activity outside Portland's ICE facility since June. In Cascade PBS, Seattle elects Katie Wilson as its next mayor. Incumbent Bruce Harrell becomes the fifth straight Seattle mayor to serve only one term. Transit Riders Union co-founder Wilson, 43, is new to elected office. In a victory speech at a Seattle Union Hall, she described herself as a socialist and a progressive. She repeated her campaign's core focus, affordability. Wilson said she plans to push for social housing, universal child care, and mass transit. In the Spokane Spokesman Review, which area school has the most lead in its water fixtures? State testing sheds light. Francis Scott Elementary School in East Central has the most lead in its fixtures. A law passed in 2021 requires the State Department of Health to test all pre-2016 water fixtures. That was the year the state mandated school water fixtures be lead-free. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind the headlines. Developers outside downtown Vancouver warned of FIFA World Cup ripple effects. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com. That's Cascadia calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate.
Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to American listeners and viewers of the Breaker.News podcast. Thank you for your support and happy Thanksgiving. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of November 23rd, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 23rd of November in 1971, diplomats from the People's Republic of China took over Taiwan's seat at the United Nations? Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca and bobmackin.substack.com. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com. Until next week.